This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Temple Grandin, has written extensively about autism and the connection she sees between autistic behavior and animal behavior. Grandin is autistic. When she was young, doctors recommended that she be institutionalized, but her mother said no. Grandin has worked to educate people about what it's like to live with autism. She's also fought for reforms in the livestock industry. She has her doctorate in animal science from the University of Illinois, teaches courses on livestock behavior and facility design at Colorado State University, and consults with the livestock industry on livestock handling and animal welfare. She spent a lot of her career designing humane handling facilities for farm animals. Her new book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Her previous books include the memoir Thinking in Pictures and the bestseller Animals in Translation. Temple Grandin, welcome back to Fresh Air. As we've discussed before on the show, you see similarities between animal behavior and autism. And in your new book, you say that, you know, one of the signs that an animal may be troubled is if they're engaging in really repetitive, compulsive behavior. What are some of those behaviors, and how does that relate to autism, too, in humans?
Well, when I was a little kid, I used to do stereotypic or repetitive behaviors. I'd sit for hours and dribble sand through my hands. Sometimes I rocked. Some children flicked the fingers in front of their eyes. I did this because loud sounds hurt my ears. So I did it to escape the loud sounds. And then I would just get fascinated watching all little sand grains, you know, go through my fingers, you know, sort of studying them like a scientist. And the thing is, if I'd been allowed to do that all day, I wouldn't be here now doing an interview. I don't know where I would be. Stereotypic behavior, repetitive behavior is highly abnormal. But there's different things that can motivate it. And this is the basis of the first chapter in the book. And I need to give my co-author, Catherine Johnson, credit for coming up with the idea of linking stereotypic behavior motivation back to Jack Panksepp's core emotions, which are fear, rage, separation anxiety, and seeking. And when I first started out, fear motivated me to do the stereotypic behavior because the loud sounds made me scared. And then seeking would take over, and I would just study the little grains of sand. I want to say that, you know, repetitive behavior is extremely abnormal. The nervous system is not working normally when an animal or a person is doing hours of repetitive stereotypies.
What are some of the typical, like, animal repetitive behaviors that are a sign that something's wrong? Like, we've all known dogs who chase their tail endlessly. Would that be an example?
That would be an example of pacing in a lion or a polar bear, a tongue rolling. Recently I saw some Jersey cows putting their heads up in the air and just waggling their tongues all around. That's totally abnormal. A gerbil that just sits in the corner digging and digging and digging constantly, that's abnormal. The main thing about a stereotypy is it's just sort of is exactly the same over and over and over again. An animal that's pacing will, you know, wear down the floor right where he paces.
So how did you break out of your repetitive behaviors like you know, watching grains of sand or rocking back and forth?
I had very good early education starting at 2.5, and I was only allowed to have an hour a day where I could do that sort of thing. And when I was in my bedroom, I'd spin this little brass thingamajig round and round and round that was on the bed frame. The rest of the time, I was kept tuned in. Speech therapy, hours of turn-taking games. I was expected to sit at the table and have table manners and ask to pass the potatoes when they needed to be passed. You know, everybody worked with me to keep my brain connected to the world. I was allowed to only have an hour a day after lunch where I could space out and revert back to autism.
And was that a pleasurable hour?
Yes, that's the thing about it, is stereotypies actually are pleasurable. They calm you down. And I think it's okay for an autistic kid to have a little bit of downtime where they can do these things and calm down. But if you let them do it all day, they're never going to get anywhere because the brain is shutting out the world.
So do you feel like you have any insights about how to break animals of that kind of, you know, like repetitive compulsive behavior?
Well, you got to start looking at what is that animal do in the wild. You take the polar bear, he's a nomad animal. He walks for miles and miles and miles and miles. Grazing animals like cattle tend to get mouth stereotypies because what do they do all day? They eat. Gerbils will get into digging stereotypies. But what gets interesting is looking at the motivation. A polar bear is turn, you know, he's seeking stuff to do. That's why he walks and walks and walks. Now, the gerbil, they thought, okay, let's make a good environment for a gerbil. Let's just give him more sand to dig in. Well, he still spends all 30% of his day digging and digging and digging. You know, but what the gerbil really wants is a place to hide because it's a prey species animal. And he's trying to dig a hole in the bottom of the aquarium, and he can't make a tunnel. Well, if you give him a tunnel, even a fake one, he'll go in there. That gives him cover. And he's digging because he feels exposed. You know, that stereotypy was motivated by fear, where the stereotypy in the polar bear was motivated by seeking.
Seeking is when you're hunting for something, looking for something, and you have anticipation that when you find it, it's going to be really good, and therefore you even get pleasure in the hunting part, in the seeking part, because of that sense of anticipation.
Well, that's right. It's, you know, it's the anticipation more than it's thinking about, you know, having a chocolate sundae more than they actually having it.
So once you know what you think might be behind the repetitive behavior in the animal, how do you break it?
Well, you've got to, one of the things that was done with Gus, the polar bear, is you had to give him things to do. Okay, the problem is it's an animal that walks for miles and miles and miles and miles. I mean, you can't do that at the Central Park Zoo. So what they did was they gave him lots of barrels that he could jump on, with all different buoyancies. And every time he jumped on these barrels in the water, they would float up at different buoyancies. And that cut down on the stereotypies. But the emphasis has to be on preventing the behavior in the first place, because the problem with stereotypic behavior is it can get entrenched into the brain and be difficult to get rid of.
In your new book, Animals Make Us Human, you describe cats as having a high level of OCD behavior, obsessive compulsive disorder behavior. What are some examples of that that you see?
Well, you can get a laser pointer out there, and boy, the cat won't stop chasing it. Now, some cats
so
don't
true.
Go after a laser pointer. But there are some cats, you get a laser pointer, they're just obsessed. In fact, you have to be careful with a laser pointer not to injure a cat, because you can get so much into chasing that little red dot that he can injure himself if you're not careful about how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that can get kind of weird is sometimes a cat can't figure out how to get out of a tree. I had a weird situation when I was a child with our Siamese cat. We had one of these old-fashioned dishwashers that pulled out like a big file drawer, and Billy got underneath the dishwasher, and he was pawing out through the crack out into the kitchen, meowing, trying to go forward. All he had to do to get out was to just back up and, you know, go out around and come out from underneath the sink, and he couldn't figure out how to do that, so I had to slowly, very, very slowly push the dishwasher in to very slowly let him back up and get out.
Now, one of the things you've been doing for many years is consulting to the livestock industry on humane handling of livestock. You've consulted on cattle, pigs, chickens. Anything I'm leaving out?
Sheep, I've done some.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think the first animals you work with like that were cows. And you built humane chutes to get the cows to slaughter. In doing this kind of work and in trying to find humane ways of keeping the livestock while they're alive and getting them to slaughter when they're killed, you've had to really understand how animals process information and how their senses compare to human senses, because some things that would upset animals wouldn't upset us. So unless we understand what upsets animals, we can't design humane systems for them. Let's start with cows. Can you compare what you know about how cows process information and what they find upsetting in terms of what they hear or see or smell that most humans would not?
Animals, I mean, especially cattle, notice visual detail, things that move rapidly, things that are high contrast. When I first started out working with the slaughter plants, I had to figure out, do they know they're getting slaughtered? So I'd go over to the Swift plant in Arizona, this was back in the early 70s, and then I'd go down to a feed yard and watch them in the vaccinating chute, and they behaved exactly the same way. And then I started to figure out, what are they really scared of? So I'd get down in the chutes and see what they were seeing, and they were scared of shadows, reflections, a chain hanging down, seeing a person walking by up in the front of the chute. And if you got rid of these things that the animals are afraid of, and the animals will walk right up the chute really, really easily. I'm still doing that kind of consulting. Just last week, I went out to out to two plants, and in one of them I found five distractions that were causing cattle to balk that they had not seen. And they were simple things, a moving yellow hose, some spraying water, a flashing light. They were simple things, but they just didn't see them.
So what happens if cattle see a yellow light or a moving hose or something that distracts them and actually scares them as they're on their way to slaughter? I mean, they're going to get killed, right? So why are we worried that they're going to be a little upset beforehand?
Well, you could say the same thing. You know, you get some old grandmother in a nursing home and say, well, let's just throw her over in the corner. She's going to die of cancer tomorrow. That doesn't matter. I mean, it gets back to relieving suffering, and there's no reason for it to be scary. In fact, there's been some research on the cortisol, the stress levels at the slaughterhouse and at the farm vaccinating chute. Yes, there is stress in both places. It's the same in both places.
So do you find when you remove the kind of distractions you were talking about that the cattle come down?
Well, the cattle will walk right up the chute if you remove the distractions. This other plant I went to, there was some piece of equipment that just screamed, and that high-pitched noise was hurting their ears. I could see it as they came up the chute. I have found that if you get rid of these distractions, then the animals will remain calm. Also, you've got to have good handling. I got to emphasize the importance of management. You know, what I have found is people are much more willing to buy the fancy new system than they are to put in the management that's required to run it correctly. And you've got to have well-trained people that are not constantly poking animals with electric prodders. And I work really hard on training people not to be carrying electric prodders around. And you've always got to be working on keeping that handling good.
You found that a lot of employees, both at livestock facilities and at slaughterhouses, don't really believe that animals have emotions.
Well, actually, the hourly employees aren't the ones that are a problem. It's some of these business manager types. I remember one time a vice president of a great big pig company asked me in all seriousness, do pigs have emotions? Well, if you look at the structure of the brain, that's really pretty silly, because the emotional circuits, let's get back to these core emotions of fear, rage, separation, anxiety, and seeking, these are subcortical brain systems. They are the same in all mammals. They have been completely mapped. Some of that research by Jack Panskap and others was done back in the 60s. I can remember in the 60s in psychology class learning about the rage cat. You know, you put an electrode in the rage center and the cat goes into a rage.
So it's been neurologically proven, you're saying, that animals have emotions.
Yeah, it's been neurologically proven, but the problem is that that's been locked up in the neuroscience literature. And, you know, people get into what they call stovepipes. You know, nobody communicates, you know, outside their area. And you've got, you know, one bunch of journals over here that's neuroscience, and then you've got another bunch of journals over there is agricultural science and veterinary science, and there's very little communication lots of times between the two. And the thing that's interesting is some of the terminology. If you look in the neuroscience literature, they'll actually use the word fear. You get into some of the other literature, and they force me to write things like excitement and agitation. But if you look at your neuroscience, there's no question that they have similar emotional systems, and these are primitive emotional systems down in the old parts of the brain that humans share with other mammals.
Now, again, you've made connections between certain animal behaviors and behavior patterns and the nervous system of people with autism. And in the case of cows, you talked about how sounds can be very upsetting, visual distractions, flashing lights can be very distracting and upsetting to cattle. Do you feel like you relate to that?
I relate to that because I'm a visual thinker. I think in pictures. Words are the index tabs that kind of trigger up the memories. It's sort of like putting search terms into Google or one of the other search engines, and then pictures come up. And so I can relate to thought without language. Because what I'm finding, and I guess this is going to give me job security, I'm just amazed. I go to two plants last week and I find a ton of distractions. I got all kinds of videos, all kinds of stuff about this, and people still have a hard time finding them. In fact, one of the ladies I was working with, she had looked through her chute looking for distractions, but she hadn't looked over the top of the chute. I found a bunch of things she hadn't noticed. The spraying water, a yellow hose moving, a flashing light. That's three things right there that I found that she hadn't noticed, and she'd actually had looked through the chute trying to find the things.
You've consulted about cattle. You've also consulted about pigs. What's some of the worst things that you found about the condition that pigs are typically kept in, the pigs who are bred for their meat?
One of my biggest concerns is overloading the biological system. This has not happened in beef cattle because they still have to be out on the range. But on pigs, dairy cattle, and chickens, just been pushing for more and more and more production to the point where the biological system just starts to fall apart. Bone problems, metabolic problems, weakness. You can push it genetically too hard. You can push it too hard with feed additives and hormones. But this is one of my biggest concerns. I mean, right now, for example, I mean, huge numbers of sows, the mother pigs are lame, and it's just structurally bad legs. You know, the pig companies are starting to correct some of that, but I'm very concerned about this. I'm very concerned about some of the bad dog breeding that's going on, where we just, you know, overselect some stupid appearance trait, or you just overselect for giant muscles or giant milk production. They've got the dairy cow so overselected for milk production now that you have a hard time getting her bred. The embryo just doesn't take.
So because pigs have been bred to create the most meat, we're ending up with like physical defects like legs that can't support their weight?
Well, it can support the weight, but you just don't have what's called good leg conformation. You know, you can, I don't want to get into all the different things on leg conformation, but they can be too straight. They can be, you know, the little dew claw things can collapse and they'll be walking on the dew claws. And the bottom line is the end up lame. And I think with all animals, we need to be looking at having, you know, animals that are structurally sound and animals that are mentally sound. When we bred the chicken for more and more and more and more eggs, one of the problems was it was a hyper-excitable chicken. When the pigs were bred, they'd just be super lean. Some of the genetic lines of the super lean pigs were real hyper-excitable.
So what are some of the worst things about the conditions in the stalls that pigs are kept in?
Well, I never liked stalls where pigs are not able to turn around. Scientific research shows that they produce just fine in those stalls. But, as far as I'm concerned, there's no life not being able to turn around. I did a little survey kind of on the airlines, and I showed the passengers pictures of sow stalls. And, you know, two-thirds of the people thought that was, not a good thing. And one guy who had hunting dogs says, well, I wouldn't keep my dogs in something like that. I think an animal needs to have a better life than, you know, being in a box where it can't turn around.
So what are some of the things you've tried to do to improve the conditions of pigs?
Well, my biggest thing with all the animals is working on handling. I've done a lot of work with many different companies on, you know, loading trucks, you know, how do you handle pigs, training people on handling of animals, the stockmanship. Stockmanship is really, really important. You know, people lots of times will buy the new thing more than their work on the stockmanship. There's been research on stockmanship by Paul Hemsworth, Jeffrey Rushen.
What is stockmanship?
Well, stockmanship is just being good at animal care.
Mm-hmm.
Like you work with your animals in such a way that your animals are not afraid of you. Because if your dairy cows are afraid of you or your pigs are afraid of you, they don't grow as well, they don't reproduce as well, they don't give as much milk.
So how do pigs compare to cows, and what scares them, and what therefore what you try to eliminate from their world?
Well, obviously, you want to totally eliminate people that are slapping and hitting and doing those kind of things. But there's differences in how pigs will react, even with two stockmen that are pretty good stockmen. I remember on one farm, there was a guy, and he was, you know, good stockman. He never abused the animals. But then when they got a new lady in the in the barn to take care of the baby piglets. You know, they actually had more litters weaned, and the sows just felt more relaxed around the lady than they did around the guy.
And what are some of the changes that you've recommended in the handling and the living conditions of pigs?
Well, in handling, just, you know, basic things. Move smaller groups, no yelling and screaming. A lot of it's very basic. You know, then they need to learn things like flight zone and point of balance. If you want an animal to go forward, I don't care what species it is, you don't stand in front of the head and poke it on the butt, because now you're telling that animal to go forward and backwards at the same time. You've got to get behind the point of balance at the animal's shoulder, get behind the shoulder, then it's going to go forward. Just teaching them some of the behavioral principles about animals. And, you know, some people have the temperament to work with animals, and some don't. There's some people that shouldn't be working with animals. But then on the other hand, to have good stockmanship, you can't have a place that's understaffed and where they're overworked, because there's no way that, you know, they can be good at taking care of the animals.
One of the things you've been doing in the livestock industry is creating audits to basically measure the welfare of cows and pigs and chickens. What's an audit like?
Well, basically, you manage things that you measure. You know, you manage weight gain, but nobody's measuring handling. One of my biggest frustrations is I'd go out to a farm or I'd go out to a slaughter plant and I'd get their handling really good, and they're using an electric prod, hardly any at all. And then I'd come back a year later and the handling was awful. And what had happened is they slowly reverted back to those old rough methods, but they didn't realize it. So the concept that I brought into it was measuring handling. Okay, how many pigs fall down? How many pigs are squealing? How many pigs did you use the electric prod on? If you measure it and count that, then you can tell, is my handling getting better or is my handling getting worse? And I developed an audit system called the American Meat Institute Guideline. Did that about 10 years ago, and that's used by McDonald's and other big companies to audit their slaughter plants. And you go in and you count, you know, how many times they use the prod. Well, sometimes people act good when you're there. So the big new frontier right now is video auditing with video cameras, with people looking in at the handling at the plant over the internet and then scoring it.
So this is done over time, and it's not like, oh, we'll just make everything look good for the one day when Temple Grandin visits, and then we'll go back.
That prevents that kind of problem, because on these video auditing systems, they'll maybe two times a day, you know, they'll score maybe, you know, 20 cattle, or you know, score a few animals, and they never know when they're looking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's five plants now on this system, and it's been going really well.
Now, you've also consulted to the poultry industry. And one of the things you say in your book, and I found this really appalling, is that there are certain procedures that are done, like beak trimming, the amputation of the toes of breeder roosters, cutting the combs of roosters, that are done with no anesthesia. And some of these procedures, particularly the beak trimming, are actually very painful. I don't even understand why these procedures need to be done in the first place. So maybe you can explain why and tell us what effect you think it has on the chickens.
Well, it definitely hurts. There's no question about that. That's been documented scientifically. The reason they do it is because sometimes chickens will peck each other and damage each other. And there is a genetic component here with the egg layer hens. When you breed egg layer hens to make more and more and more and more eggs, you also tend to breed a hen that's worse about pecking other chickens. Bill Muir at Purdue University has done a lot of work on genetic selection. And to get rid of having to cut beaks on chickens is probably going to require selecting for some genetics where it's kind of a kinder and gentler chicken. And you have to give up a little bit of egg production, not a whole lot, but just a little bit. You know, this gets back to pushing the biology. You know, you just select for one thing like egg production, or you just select for one thing like milk production. Other bad things tend to get linked along with it.
Have you come up with ways to improve poultry slaughter?
Well, one of the big things I've done on that, again, is the measurement system. When I first started working with poultry, I remember going out to this farm. They were catching chickens. It was terrible, running them over with a forklift. And they thought it was normal to have 5%, 5 to 6% of the birds having a broken wing. I was watching what they were doing. I go, this is just rough handling. So then in one of the plants, we started measuring it, and we very quickly got it down to 1%. And one of the best ways to clean that up is to put the catching crews on incentive pay. Like each person might get an extra $30 a week if they don't bust up the chickens. And again, just simple measurement improved a lot of things. You know, some of the other problems were leg problems from rapid growth. Fortunately, in some of the chicken companies have started to correct that problem.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written extensively about her life with autism. She's written about the connections that she thinks exist between animals and animal behavior and autistic behavior. And she also consults to the livestock industry on humane conditions for housing animals and for slaughtering them. Her latest book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. You've written about how, because you do have autism, you don't really like physical contact with people. You've chosen to avoid romantic love in your life. You choose to live alone. What about kind of physical contact with animals? Do you enjoy petting them? Do you enjoy things like a cat sitting in your lap and snuggling up against you?
Yes, and I really enjoy stroking an animal. And you don't want to pat an animal. You want to stroke it, kind of just firm strokes like mother's tongue. And I really get a lot of enjoyment if I can stroke an animal and the animal's obviously liking it. Like the kitty will rub up against me and the dog is, Mark, my assistant, had a little dog named Annie. And all she wanted to do when she saw me was to roll over on her belly and have me scratch her belly. And, you know, cattle sometimes, you rub them on the neck just right, they put their head up in the air and they kind of go, oh, that just feels so good. I do get pleasure out of, stroking an animal and seeing that animal get happy when you do it.
What else gives you pleasure beyond work?
Talking about autism with other people, talking about animals with other people, talking about engineering with other people, talking about really interesting stuff. And I can relate to another lady that's got Asperger's. She was giving a talk, and she was telling me that, she and her husband have this great romantic dinners and really nice restaurant with candles and everything else. And that sets the stage for a beautiful romantic conversation on computer data storage systems.
I love it.
Because it's just so interesting. And I can completely relate to that.
Now, when you were diagnosed with autism in the 1950s, not too much was known about the science behind autism, you know, like what's really going on. And I don't think that the diagnosis of Asperger syndrome even existed yet, at least, and if it did, it wasn't widely acknowledged. So knowing what you know now about Asperger's and autism, where do you place yourself on the spectrum of autism? And by spectrum, I mean that I think, you know, scientists and doctors agree now that there's different levels of autism and that, you know, different people fall, you know, on different levels. Some have mild, some have severe. There's all kinds of cases in between. So where do you think you fit in on that spectrum now?
Well, autism is a continuum going all the way from geniuses like Einstein down to somebody that remains very nonverbal and will have to live in a supervised living situation. Now, if you go according to the American Psychiatric Association DMS-IV manual, to be autistic, you have to have delayed speech. And Asperger's, there's no delayed speech. So if you use that criteria, then I would be what they call high-functioning autism. See, the problem you have with this diagnosis is it's not precise. It's not like taking a lab test for tuberculosis, they can tell you exactly what kind of TB you've got. It's basically kind of a behavioral profile. In fact, there's a lot of arguments going on right now about how these diagnostic categories may change when they put out the next version of the book in 3 years. And I think it's rather weird that doctors had to sign a non-disclosure secrecy agreement to not discuss what they were going to put in the next version of the book.
So you're not sure where you fall? Is that what you're saying? Because
well, I had delayed speech. In other words, when I was 2 years old, I had full-blown classic autistic symptoms. So according to, some people, that would put me as autistic. But in terms of my functioning level now, it would be more like Asperger's. The thing is, it's a continuum of traits. In fact, scientists are starting to track down some of the genetics. They're finding out things like abnormal gesture and delayed speech or different genetic factors are involved in that. And I think eventually they're going to split the syndrome apart into its component parts, like lack of social relatedness, gesture abnormalities, speech delay, things like that.
You mentioned Einstein a moment ago. Do you think Einstein had Asperger's?
Einstein, according to DMS-IV criteria, would be labeled autistic because he had no speech until age 3. In fact, I have a Xerox copy of a letter that an autistic parent got from Einstein, basically saying that his parents were really worried about his delayed speech.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written a lot about autism, a condition that she has, and she's also written a lot about the connection between animals and autism. And her new book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Now, when you were diagnosed with autism, there weren't nearly the number of medications that there are now that deal with the biochemistry of the brain. Have you found any medications to be particularly helpful with symptoms that you find problematic?
Well, in my early 30s, I started taking antidepressant medicine to stop the constant panic attacks. I wouldn't be functioning if I wasn't on that medication. Because I had these horrible panic attacks, and when I do autism talks, I say to people, well, just imagine in this conference center here, we just lock the doors, turn the lights out, and then we throw a few baskets full of rattlesnakes and cobras in this room, and it's pitch black in this convention center. Imagine how you're going to feel. That's the way I felt all the time, and the medication stopped that. Now, I want to emphasize, I think there's way too many powerful drugs given out way too casually to the little kids, way too many powerful drugs. But there's a number of older children than adults where careful use of medication, and I want to emphasize that if you use an antidepressant, something like Prozac, it's tiny doses, tiny, tiny doses. In fact, in my book, Thinking in Pictures, I totally revised all the medication section. The mistake that's made is they give too much. People get on too much stuff. You need to figure out what are the few things that actually work. And it's very variable. You know, one person will be helped by antidepressants, another person, they're not going to work. This is where autism is just so variable.
Has finding drugs that help you quiet your nervous system and function better helped you understand what's actually going on in your nervous system?
Well, it's what's happened. It's kind of interesting. Is there's kind of two mechanisms. You have the orienting. Okay, you hear a sound in the middle of the night when you're in your house, and you orient. And then you go, oh, man, is there a burglar in the house? Then your heart starts pounding. That's the fear. And what's happened now with me is the orienting is still there, but it's stopped a lot of the fear. Sometimes I have trouble sleeping at night because the next-door neighbor's car beeps when he starts the car. And I orient towards that. I can't help it. But that used to just cause a great big massive panic reaction. Even though I know it's the next-door neighbor's car, it's not going to do anything to me. But that's blocked now by the medication. It's blocked that massive fear response, but the tendency to orient towards the beep is still there, so it still keeps me up.
Now, how does your body and how does your nervous system respond to physical pain? Even the ordinary aches and pains of aging, does that send you into panic, or are you okay at coping with that?
No, I've got quite a bit of back pain, and I'm coping with that.
So that doesn't frighten you? You can handle that?
Yeah, I can handle the pain. In fact, when I had a major surgery, the nurse told me that I used very little pain medication compared to some of the other patients.
Now, why do you think that is? Like, so many people can't deal with pain. Like, pain is very upsetting. Pain hurts. And you seem to cope with pain fine, and yet, you know, somebody's car beeping is going to send you into panic if you're not on medication.
Well, that's a common thing with a lot of people, you know, with autism. They're more pain tolerant.
Really? Has anybody investigated why?
That's something that probably needs to be investigated. One of the things that really needs to be investigated in autism are the sensory sensitivity problems. And they're very variable, from mild nuisances to being totally debilitating. There are some people on the spectrum, in fact, smart Asperger people on the spectrum, that can't tolerate a normal office because they can see the flicker, the 60-cycle flicker of fluorescent lights. They feel like they're in a disco. They can't tolerate just the noise of, you know, office equipment, things like that, because it hurts their ears. And these sensory problems are now just starting to get researched. I mean, I've been a big proponent of saying to researchers, please, you've got to study these problems. They are just so debilitating. You know, how can a person socialize or live a normal life if they're if every little phone ringing or something hurts their ears?
Right. You recently wrote a book that's about social skills and teaching social skills to people. Do you feel like you had to be taught social skills, that you didn't have any intuitive understanding of them, that you had to be shown what the rules are?
I had to just be taught. This is where my 50s upbringing, I think, really helped me. All kids back in the 50s were taught to say please and thank you. They were taught table manners. My parents and my nanny spent hours playing turn-taking games, you know, little board games, Chinese checkers, parcheesi, things like this, to teach turn-taking, because I have to learn social skills like acting in a play. Now, the thing is, there's differences in how many social circuits are hooked up. It's going to be very, very variable.
You've said that when you first started working, that because you really didn't understand certain social skills, you would dress in a very kind of unkempt way. Your personal hygiene wasn't the greatest until you were told that this had to change. So when you were told and you changed, Were you insulted? You know, most people, if you say to them, "Wow, you're dressing unkempt," or you have bad personal hygiene, they'd be really offended. But does that kind of personal offense register on you? Do you take
it
that way?
Oh, no, yeah, I was absolutely furious. But I did it because I wanted to keep the job. Now, I still dress kind of eccentric. And I think eccentric's fine. But a filthy, dirty slob, that's not fine. In fact, I've gotten after some other people on the spectrum for showing up at an important meeting, you know, with a dirty T-shirt and told them to go up to their room and get a different shirt. You know, but on the other hand, you can't totally de-geek the geek and don't even try. You can't. You can't make me into something that I'm not. You know, you have to, it's sort of like you've got to meet halfway.
I've noticed you do like to use the word geek. Is it helpful? Are you pleased that there is such a word now and that it's a word that we all talk about with approval? You know what I mean? Like there's something really cool about geekdom now. We all kind of appreciate computer geeks and math geeks. We know we need them. You know, we respect them. So has that been really helpful to have geek have a certain hipness to it now?
Yeah, and what I get concerned about is that I've seen some very smart kids getting labeled Asperger's and seen it hold them back, and this really concerns me because you get out into the areas where there's a lot of tech industry. Those kids are often kind of apprenticed into that industry. You know, mom and dad are in the computer industry. They teach their kids how to do it. But then you've got some kid out in the Midwest, and bagging groceries, no, he certainly doesn't want to do that. And the educational system doesn't know what to do with a smart techie. But the thing is, there's a lot of job opportunities around. There's lots of interesting stuff around. Well, I remember one time I was in Texas, and they said, well, what do we do out here in the middle of nowhere in Texas? I said, well, you got oil wells. They're interesting. There's gas pumping stations. Those are interesting. You know, natural gas stations. There's cattle feed yards. I remember one time seeing a wonderful old antique airplane that was being remodeled in a dumpy old hangar. That'd be the perfect place for somebody to mentor a kid with Asperger's. What you got to do with these smart kind of geeky kids is find somebody that can get them turned on, even if it's something like auto repairs. I mean, cars are complicated these days. You got to get creative on getting, you know, getting these kids' obsessions channeled into something that may come, you know, a satisfying life.
And you could be a music geek, too. It doesn't have to be a computer.
That's right. You can definitely be a music geek. You see, and there's kind of different kinds of minds. I'm the photorealistic pattern thinker, terrible at algebra. In fact, I'm finding a number of kids that absolutely cannot do algebra, but they can do geometry and trig, and they need to be allowed to skip algebra and go to geometry and trig. And then the teachers say, well, he just does it, and he doesn't show his work. And I said, yeah, but his mind works differently. You need to let him do that. Once you rule out cheating, then just let him do it. Then there's other kids that are pattern thinker. They think in patterns. And that's the music mind, the computer programmer mind. That's not me. I'm the visual thinking mind. And then you've got the kind of a word thinker. They'll know every sports statistic, every weather statistic. And they're just kind of average in math.
Well, Temple Grandin, I really want to thank you for talking with us and coming to Fresh Air again. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Temple Grandin's new book is called Animals Make Us Human. Over 30 years ago, a British filmmaker named Tony Palmer began the ambitious project of putting together a 17-part series on the history of popular music for London Weekend Television, a commercial channel in Britain. The last episode aired in 1980. It's now available as a 5-DVD set. Recently, our rock historian Ed Ward sat down and watched the whole thing.
All You Need Is Love. They couldn't even get the theme music right. The note where you'd sing need goes up instead of staying the same. Maybe they thought they were improving it. Although, given the rest of the stuff on these DVDs, I just put it down to sloppiness. It's incredible. In the mid-70s, when these films were made, nobody knew more about pop music than the British. Yet, day after day, I watched, taking notes, agog at the misperceptions and downright errors here. What were they thinking? And who was this guy Tony Palmer who threw this dog's dinner together? Is he the guy with the weedy voice who narrates the incoherent first episode and informs us that, among other things, jazz did not come up the river from New Orleans and blues didn't come from West Africa? Well, of course not. The Africans who sold slaves to the Europeans weren't selling their own people. but I bet Palmer was responsible for the footage of a searing performance by Fela Anikulapu Kuti, probably the most important pop musician to come out of Nigeria in the 20th century, and calling it a strident imitation of white rock music. It doesn't get better after that, at least not for a good long while. Among other things, there's the bizarre editing which characterizes most of the episodes, giving us a montage of the Count Basie Orchestra and the Ku Klux Klan, B.B. King playing The Thrill Is Gone behind Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and, most memorably of all, footage of cowboys riding bulls in a rodeo, while Nick Lucas, an American singer who introduced the song in the 1920s, sings Tiptoed Through the Tulips. But eventually the series gets a little better. When Palmer turns the script over to Jack Good for the rock and roll episode, the one dealing with Elvis, Gene Vincent, Carl Perkins, and Little Richard, things finally turn around. Good was the youngest producer at BBC Television when rock and roll hit England, and the shows he produced did far more than radio to spread the word of the new music. His self-deprecating memories and sense of humor about Britain's early rockers give an unusual insight into the birth of a culture in a country which would give it back to the land of its birth in a radically changed style.
In England, when rock started, there were no musicians who had any background in anything that would subsequently have anything to do with rock. The British popular music had been, ever since the advent of jazz, totally imitative. Tommy Steele, for instance, his band was abominable, and he just came on to the stage and yelled at the audience. And it was a really revolting display because it meant nothing. It was totally empty. The music was awful, and it was just an example of how foolish the public were to watch such a thing.
The Beatles episode follows, and again Palmer turns the script over to the right person, Derek Taylor, who was the press officer for the Beatles, the Birds, and the Beach Boys, and whose wry take on the whole thing saturates the episode. It's a masterpiece of concision, fitting not only the Beatles, but the whole Summer of Love and the Monterey Pop Festival, which Taylor also had a hand in, into its 51 minutes. Next, we get Sour Rock, not a label which stuck, which deals with the Rolling Stones, the deaths of Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and Jim Morrison, and the hippie dream going bad. The last two episodes, though, have a secret weapon. Rock critic Lester Bangs, young, articulate, sarcastic, and in fine form, denouncing mid-70s rock as only someone deeply immersed in it could.
I've never had to pay any dues because I grew up not rich, but with enough money. I could always afford any record, any magazine I wanted. You know, I had a car, this and that. We lived in the suburbs. Our parents supported us in general. We had the leisure to screw ourselves up, you know. Musically, something's going to have to happen pretty soon. It's like waiting for the Renaissance, you know, when everybody thinks that it has to happen. It's commonly said that every, you know, 10 years there's a big star and it's in the middle of the decade. Dick Clark said this in an interview I did once. He said, well, you know, there was Sinatra in the 40s and there was Elvis in the 50s and the Beatles in the 60s and now's the time, and that was 2 years ago. And nothing has happened.
His insights are startlingly apt, not to mention prophetic. It's entirely possible that as he was saying that last bit, his friend Patti Smith in New York was urging Hilly Kristal to let her boyfriend's band play at Kristal's bar, CBGB's, thereby igniting a revolution which would wipe the bloated excess these episodes document so well from public consciousness. To be fair, there are moments in all the episodes which are worth watching. Ubi Blake, then in his 90s, is incredibly articulate and funny when discussing ragtime, and Irving Caesar, in his 80s, casually mentions how he wrote all of his hit tunes in under 15 minutes, including T for Two, which, he claims, took 6 minutes to write. John Hammond takes the film crew to the club where he first saw Billie Holiday and talks candidly about racism in the music business, and Artie Shaw projects a sharp intelligence talking about the swing era. Some of the documentary footage is astonishing, too. A mind-bogglingly racist newsreel of John Lomax and Leadbelly recreating Lomax's discovery of the singer. Actual footage of a cakewalk, Marlena Dietrich in a gorilla suit, and a film performance by Jimmy Rogers. But all of this is fed through an almost knee-jerk anti-Americanism, typified by the omnipresent rodeo footage and footage of Disneyland, which drives home the idea that Americans are buffoons, and an elevation of some musical question marks like British jazzer Mike Gibbs, British protest songwriter Leon Rosselson, and the Japanese show-off drummer Stomo Yamashita. It's a product of its time and place, and while I wouldn't necessarily recommend it for your collection, maybe your public library or video rental place has it. If so, watch at your own risk, but do grab that last disc with the Beatles, Stones, and Lester Bangs.
Ed Ward lives in southern France. Ed sends a special thanks to British rock historian Peter Frame. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Love is all you need. Love is all you need. Love is all you need. Love is all.